Hi, welcome to Nikonian's Behind the Lens podcast series at podcasts.nikonians.org. I'm Jason Odell, and today I'm in Chicago, Illinois, in the United States, with very famous photographer, Mr. Arnold Crane. And while you may not have heard of Arnold Crane directly, let me tell you why he's so important. Arnold has been a photographer for the last 62 years. He was born in Chicago, and he is really special because he's one of the last living connections between the huge, giant photographers, all of the names that you've heard of from the 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s. I'm talking about Ansel Adams, Man Ray, Henri Cartier-Bresson, and Robert Duano, and the list goes on from there. Arnold's collection is considered to be one of the cornerstones of the photography collection at the Getty Museum in Los Angeles. His work has appeared in the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York, in Chicago, in Miami, everywhere. In 1995, Arnold published a book called On the Other Side of the Camera, and it is a collection of his images of all of these iconic photographers. So Arnold, thank you so much for allowing me into your home and to spend some time with us at Nikonians.
You're very, very welcome. I was looking forward to this, Jason.
Well, I'm sure everyone at the site will be looking forward to hearing what you have to say. So before we get into the nitty-gritty of all the people who you've met and all your world adventures, how did you get started in photography?
Well, my dad had a movie camera in the drawer of his desk that did not have a lens. When I was about 4 years old or 3 years old, I was looking through it and grinding away at it and just loved to look through a lens. And it went from there to a box brownie, to a Kodak monitor 620, and then my dream was a speed graphic, which I got when I was in high school. I got a 4x5 speed graphic, and I began to take pictures. I followed police calls. I went to fires. I went to murders. I went I went with the police to robberies and post robberies, of course. And I was a freelance photographer, and I worked for the Chicago papers as a freelance, and I also did 600 weddings during that time.
Oh, so you did a little bit of everything.
Wedding photographer.
So you would say you started out kind of as the classic freelance photojournalist.
You got it.
Okay, so that's awesome.
And a few drownings here and there.
Oh, living here by the lake, you get that. When did you first pick up an SLR? When did you start using SLR cameras? I know that was later.
Yeah, first picked up an SLR. Let's see, I practiced law, and it was about when Nikon Fs came out.
Okay. Which would have been late 50s, I'm thinking.
Yeah.
Early 60s.
Yeah.
Okay.
I bought my first Nikon Fs directly from a place called Kitao Camera Shop in Osaka. I still remember the address. Okay. And Paul Schutt, who was the current owner of Helix in Chicago, gave me the address. He was a grad student at the time. And gave me the address of Kitao, and I bought my cameras and lenses directly from Japan.
That's one way of doing it, I guess. Now, do you still have any of those old?
I have them all.
Okay. You see, you're a Nikonian, then. You have everything
in
your closet.
I have the Nikon Fs, F2s, God knows, F4s, F5s, F100s.
And now you're shooting a digital camera.
D2X.
D2X. Oh, excellent. And we'll come back to that topic in a little bit.
Gladly.
So this important body of work here that I'm holding, this book On the Other Side of the Camera.
Yeah.
How did you get the idea for this? This is a collection of casual photographs, candids.
Yeah.
Of all of the giants.
Natural light.
Natural light. So no flash, no studios.
Well, I was practicing law. I practiced law for 27 and a half years as a trial lawyer. And I had a lot of downtime because I had a, I was the business getter and the trial lawyer, and my partner was the drone. So I didn't have to spend too much time in the office, except when I was on trial. But Steichen came to Chicago. The Exchange Bank in Chicago had a large photographic collection. And for one of their first shows, they had Edward Steichen come in. And he was formerly the curator of photography. But anyway, Steichen was a rather older man at that time. I can't say an old man. I'm 74. And I still feel young. I then went to Paris. I shouldn't say that. I was at an auction in Bern, Switzerland, the auction of the famous Tristan Zara collection. And Tristan Zara was one of the formers of the Dada movement. And they auctioned his collection after he died. And I went to that particular auction and talked to one of the assistants at the auction house who got me an introduction to Man Ray. I proceeded to go to Paris, and this was 1968. Went into Paris at the time of the student riots with the tear gas going in the streets, and was sort of unable to get to the from the airport by cab and managed by bus. Got to Man Ray's house and photographed him and did some enlarged contacts of Man, and mm-hmm. those went into the Modern, took him to Peter Bunnell at the Modern. He said, why don't you do, he liked my pictures, why don't you photograph all the photographers?
Oh, so you were in the right place at the right time for that job, huh?
I was in the right place at the right time, and these were my heroes.
Excellent. Now, and then you didn't publish the book until...
Well, I didn't publish the book. Kornemann Verlag in Cologne was the publisher. I refused to be that egocentric to pay for my own publishing.
The book was published, I should
yes.
say. Now, there's a huge list, a huge cast of characters. I mean, this is about 25 people that you photographed in this
all
book.
All but one who has since deceased.
And
they're all gone.
Tell me about this photograph on the front cover, because this is a classic.
It's
this
horrible photograph. I didn't want it to be the cover, but my publisher said, this is the cover.
It will certainly attract attention.
It's Man Ray with his finger in his nose.
Yeah, it's really classic.
The title of the book is on the other side of the camera. I no longer get royalties because my publisher went out of business. But if you want the book, you can buy it on eBay.
Oh, there you go.
And I don't get any money for it.
Well, okay. Of all of the folks here on the back, tell us, who was the most interesting to work with?
That's an interesting story. Man Ray was probably, I was probably as close to Man Ray and Walker Evans and Ansel Adams. I think mm-hmm. Ansel was kind of, I would call Ansel a friend. Arnold Newman was a friend, and I gave a eulogy to Arnold a couple of weeks ago at a large format seminar. And Gary Winogrand. Gary was probably my closest friend. Gary drank more of my scotch than I drank Chicago water. And Gary was quite wonderful. Gary, myself, Lee Friedlander, we'd do some palling around. Loved them all. Bernice Abbott was wonderful. Stayed at her house. Stayed with Walker a lot. Spent an awful lot of time with Man Ray. They were all wonderful, but one. And I will tell you.
Maybe we should just leave that one alone.
We're leaving them alone. But if you look at one particular photographer in my book, and you look at all the ugly pictures of him,
you might have
you
an idea.
Will know who it is the short biography that I wrote.
How long did it take you to put together the body of work? That's the book.
The first picture is, I believe, 1950, and the last one was 1995. I did Arnold Newman at the end.
Okay, so that was just a huge project then. It was sort of a back burner project.
I started about 66, 67. Yeah, I mm-hmm. think they did Steichen and 67, 68. I don't recall exact dates. I'm terrible on numbers.
Which of these giants inspired your personal work the most?
That's a very interesting question.
So we all have our heroes.
Yeah. Man Ray was a hero. And some people have looked at my very large photographs that have been in shows in Cologne and here. I do close-ups of people. I do eyes. I do essentially landscapes of the female body. But I think they all, because Man Ray, one of his famous things was his metronome with an eye on it and his eyes with glass tears, of course, which everybody who's gone through a history book, a photographic history book, knows. But I think they were all influential to me. Gary was a street photographer. He did a lot of work on the streets in New York and Chicago. I was around with, would go around with him here in Chicago when he taught at the Art Institute, or I think Institute or Institute of Design. And Gary would always get me to carry something for him. And I always had one hand occupied, so I couldn't photograph when he was photographing. But everybody was really an influence. Arthur Siegel was probably the greatest influence in retrospectively thinking. Arthur is in my book. Some people may not know him, but he was a student of Moholy's, and he ended up as the director of the photography department, which was the new Bauhaus at the Institute of Design, which was equivalent of the new Bauhaus. And Harry Callahan was there, Aaron Siskin was there, but Arthur was the main force. And when I was a young lawyer just out of law school, I got a job as an insurance adjuster. Everybody has to have another job. I was a soda jerk with my dad's, in my dad's drugstore before that. So mm-hmm. I can really sling ice cream. and I still love ice cream. And Arthur's wife had broken a tooth in a fall when she had delivered a baby at the hospital. And she had fallen after the delivery, of course, and chipped a tooth. And I went to the house, didn't realize whose house it was. And it turned out to be Arthur's house. And I mean, this Arthur was a time in life photographer at the mm-hmm. time. And I went in there and I realized this was the great Arthur Siegel. And I walked into the house, which is in Chicago, with a little brick house down on the north side. And as I walked in, there were his cameras lined up.
Oh, wow.
And I realized that this was the great Arthur Siegel. And of course, I gave them the store. I mean, I gave them a good settlement. And I asked Arthur, how do I become a photographer? And at that time, I had done my 600 weddings to get me through law school. But I really wanted to be a photographer. And I wanted to go with the newspapers, and Al Krauss of the Tribune said, you're not going to be one of these bums. He thought that the press photographers were kind of bums, I mean, as all the newspapermen were at that time. These were cigar-chomping, beer-drinking people, and it was a rough crowd because this was a rough town. And Arthur said, just look at photo books. Look at books. And I did. And I've built up this absolutely grand library that I still have. I mean, the photographic library, the Incunabula, or the early books, the daguerreotype manuals and all of those things are currently in the Getty Museum. But I built up a photographic library, and I have hundreds of books, maybe thousands, in the bedroom. Double stacked. All my libraries are double stacked because I never have enough room.
Yeah, you got a lot of bookshelves here, I've already noticed.
Yeah. And the room that you're staying in is an ethnographic library, African, Oceanic, American, Native American. Mm-hmm. But that's kind of how I learned. And I learned and I photographed and looked at other people's pictures. And your style, I guess, happens as depending upon the equipment you're using and the conditions you're in. The different equipment will force you to use different styles.
Right.
If you're using a rangefinder, if you're using a reflex camera, and you're photographing somebody asleep on a park bench, and this is what happened to me, the shutter will wake them. So you Right. use a rangefinder camera, whatever that may be. Mm-hmm. If you happen to have an original Nikon rangefinder camera, that's very nice. But I was using Leicas in those days, mm-hmm. which I still use, like for film. And of course, I use Nikons for film because I love reflex cameras. When you want to work like a mouse, you use a rangefinder camera. Mm. But I carry my Nikons. You know, I'm carrying one body now because it's a little bit more appropriate for my age and strength.
Well, let's talk about that before we get to your foray into digital photography. Yeah. Obviously your love is still, I can tell from being around, you know, black and white film.
Yeah.
Do you even have a favorite Nikon? Favorite camera, favorite lens?
Or, yeah.
Because I mean, you've used them all.
I've used them all. Well, the more advanced they got, the better I liked them. I loved my F5s, but I found that the F100 would do everything the F5 would do. It wasn't as sturdy, but never broke down on me. I have three of them. I always went with mm-hmm. batteries of three. Jay Mazel taught me to have a battery of three cameras because when I was using Leicas in the earlier days, before I went from Nikon to Leica back to Nikon, I had three Leicas. I was in Shanghai. There was a rain. Two of the Leicas broke down on me. I had to fly to Hong Kong to get them repaired.
That must have been a journey.
Flew back. You did it. You uh-huh. know, I was doing some jobs. And I had a mission. And I got them repaired, and I came back. And Leica is so advanced, you know. They don't have autofocus. Well, you got to have autofocus. Jay and I spoke one day. He said, Arnold, we're both getting older. We need autofocus. And I went into, F5s.
Okay.
Bought my first F5. Loved it.
Wonderful camera.
Incredible. Bought a second, bought a third. Mm-hmm. Because Jay's philosophy is you got to be backed up. And when one goes down, you're still backed up with two more.
There you go.
So, but I only have one D2X.
Right.
Because they're expensive.
They are certainly that. I mean, it's a whole different ballgame
yeah.
now.
Yeah.
Now, how have you adjusted to, when did you started digital, what, about a year ago?
Yeah, it's painful.
So what's been your challenge with moving to the digital medium?
The learning curve for me. Mm-hmm. For me is the learning curve. I'm conceptual. I didn't go to medical school because it's hard for me sometimes to just learn to memorize. I'm more into theoretical concepts.
Uh-huh.
I could try a case without notes, but I'd have to write down the names of the jurors and numbers if numbers came up. I don't remember numbers. I don't remember names.
Okay.
I remember larger groups. So when it comes to minutiae of dealing with digital, as you and I have gone through the workflow, I have to have checklists because I'll just get crazy. I won't forget these. I mean, I won't remember these things, and it'll drive me nuts.
Has picking up the D2X changed your style at all, or do you
no.
still keep that the same?
No, I think a camera is a camera is a camera. Mm-hmm. Very exciting to look at. To get instant gratification
yes.
in the back. And as you've taught me, the word chimping is really kind of fun.
We all need to add that to our vocabulary,
yes.
don't we?
Yes.
So that's great. So what is your mission with learning digital photography? What do you hope to achieve with setting up a digital workflow environment?
I just hope to be able to get some pictures and get some personal pleasure. Maybe if somebody wants to buy some of my pictures, they can. I have not created a website, but I'm very, very close, because you've gotten me to the point where I can at least make a print. And
don't give me that much credit.
I might as well. Everybody asked me, what's your website? My pictures of the photographers are kind of unique in the photo world, in that they really are, they're environmental. They're environmental portraits. Uh-huh. And I won't say I captured essences, because essence is a very funny word in a picture. It's a moment in time. And they're a real moment in time. They have a very fast trigger finger. And the Nikon, and I was using Nikon Fs at the time when I started this project. So I had an exposure meter, a Nikon F, nothing automatic,
right,
and a very fast trigger finger, and a soft release on my Nikon, a special soft release that I would screw in, and they were available in those days. And I had soft releases on my Leicas. We see them interchangeably at the same time. And I had a large number of lenses. The Leicas I would use more for wide angle, and the Nikons I was using, you know, semi-wide angle to normal and long. And I had a project. I just wanted to document these people, and I did. I never thought of putting it into a book. And I made prints. I had a couple of shows. I had a show at the Corcoran Gallery in 1974. Show in Kansas City. I had my works in the Wellesley Museum, in the Lowe Museum in Miami, Wellesley College Museum, the Modern, the Met. So a lot of people bought my pictures.
That must feel pretty good.
As my contracts professor said, when you have a cause of action as a client, you're 6 feet tall. And it makes you feel 6'2".
There you go. Now, you photographed a ton of stuff. What if you had a day to shoot whatever you wanted to in terms of subjects?
Yeah.
How do you relax behind your camera? What is the fun thing for you to go out and shoot? What do you like to do?
The funnest thing for me to shoot, or the most fun, my funnest.
grammatical would be to checker.
Go to a third world country,
uh-huh,
which you can't do anymore. I mean, you can go to China or Thailand. Thailand's not exactly, well, I guess it's a third world country. I would go to India. I was up in Kashmir, and I would do just travel pictures. And I had a couple of agents. I, you know, worked did some stuff for stock houses, sold a number of things, made lots of money. I did catalogs too. You know, I've done down and dirty, but that paid for a lot of equipment. But I would love to do travel photography. And as you know, that I had a couple of health setbacks. I've had two open hearts.
Mm-hmm.
And that'll slow you down a little bit.
That does take the wind out of your sails
that
to a certain degree.
That takes the wind out of your sails. But I'm not, I won't give up until somebody forces me to. And the only time I'm really happy is other than, you know, my family, is when I have a camera in my hands. That's the only thing I really want to do. I don't read a lot anymore. I mean, I had enough to get through law. I mean, you know, it was enough getting through law school to read everything. I read some medical journals because legal medicine was essentially what I did. I just love to play with a camera. I mean, I think you love to play with a computer. Well, the computer doesn't fascinate me. This computer scares the heck out of me.
trying to work on that, though. We'll get you straightened out.
But I'd love to have a camera in my hands. I love equipment. I love what'll happen with a camera.
Mm-hmm.
I just love a camera. That sounds crazy.
No, I understand exactly.
Yeah,
and I think a lot of our members will understand exactly what you're talking about as well.
And by the way, I had a full contacts system. I mean, you know, talk about
it.
You're not paid by Nikon. So you're talking about the best camera. You want to talk? Can I talk about the best camera I had ergonomically?
You may.
The best camera I have ever used, and I have three of these, is the RTS3 with the Zeiss lenses. And I've got to tell you, it is the most ergonomically friendly. The camera had a vacuum back, sucked the film up, always clean exposures, and it would meter for strobe.
Cool.
Internal metering for strobe. I mean, you couldn't ask for anything more. The greatest film camera ever made. And I have all of the Zeiss lenses. If I was shooting another show of my nudes, I would probably use, if I'm going very large, I might use black and white film in the contacts. I mean, the Contax is that wonderful to use. I'm sorry to tell you.
Oh, that's
however, I needed some very specific detail in a certain situation, and I called the film people in Hollywood, the picture people, and I wanted to know what was essentially the best macro lens I could get for
your
systems.
Right.
And they told me that 200 macro, the Nikon 200 macro. I have that lens. They were right. And that's the lens that is used frequently, adapted for the various 35mm film cameras, I believe.
And that, a lot of those of us in the macro forums know that that's one of the a wonderful, wonderful lens. Now, you've been trying out, I saw you on your camera, you've been using that new 105 VR macro.
Why not?
And how is that?
It's lovely.
You like it?
Yes, it's beautiful.
Good, good. Because that, you know, so old technology, new technology, you appear to embrace it all.
Yeah, it makes people look older than they are. I guess right down to their wrinkles.
Oh, that's great. Well, let me ask you something. You've been around the world.
Missed Singapore.
You missed Singapore. Okay.
Yeah. On purpose.
What, putting on your photojournalism hat, let me switch the topic to what was your most, you know, what did you ever get the perfect shot as a photojournalist? What was the most interesting experience or most challenging, or just what experience, if you've got one, sticks out in your mind? So when I went on this assignment, wow, that was something unheard of.
I was in Cuba, and I was photographing an Elian Gonzalez protest rally in Havana. And that was a picture I entered. I'm a member of the White House News Photographers also. And I entered that in our contest and took an honorable mention. I was in the middle of thousands of people. And I sort of bravely or stupidly yelled, American journalist. And I was walking through, and they were wonderful. And they loved Americans. This was very strange. And they're waving their Cuban flags. And I was photographing. And they were posing. And I had to get them unposed. And I had to get them when they were really excited and natural. And I did. Not before their Secret Service, because Castro was going to be at this rally. And the Secret Service had grabbed me. And they made me show them all my equipment. They took my vest, which had all my money in it.
Oh, geez.
And I was worried that they were going to steal it. But I got everything back. I was kind of angry when they did it, but I went into the crowd stupidly without fear. And, you know, luckily that they were not anti-American. They were just anti-people that were holding Elian Gonzalez in Florida.
Oh, that's amazing.
And then I photographed a streetcar gasoline truck that caught fire where 35 people were burned to death. And they opened the rear doors of the streetcar, pried them open, and there were the bodies jammed against it. And I had photographed this with my 4x5 speed graphic in my career when I believe I was in law school at the time or undergrad school at Loyola here in Chicago. And I brought the pictures down to the Sun-Times. They went all over the country. And it was the nicest thing I can say. It was gross, and it was life-altering for me to see all of these bodies piled up. And the odor, which I will not describe. I have a description. I really don't want people to know what burnt flesh looks, smells like.
Yeah, that's probably best left alone.
But because every time I smell something similar, it brings me back to that time. I mean, it really is a deja vu situation.
So tell me a little bit about what you're working on now. What do you have, any projects going on or anything current?
That's one of life's problems, to get a new project. I was working on a book on the United States Marine Corps, which is a pet project of mine. I had done some volunteer work during the 5.5 or 6 years I lived in New York. This was from 95 on. And I was living between New York, Chicago, and Washington. And I became friendly with some Marines in New York, and I spent a lot of time in the office answering telephones, going to CAPEXs. CAPEXs are exercises. And I got a carte blanche. I met the commandant very early, General Krulak, who was one of the most incredible people I ever met. He was a 4-star general and was the commandant of the Marine Corps. And I was at the Pentagon and went into his office, and he said, what do you want? I said, I want a letter from you, total access. And he flew into New York the following week for a meeting. I met the plane. My group from New York, the Public Affairs Office of the Marine Corps, met the plane, and he hands me a folder, and in the folder was a letter of total access.
Can't beat that, can you?
No, I've got it in my office. I made some Xerox copies of it, and I could go anywhere, anytime I wanted, and they had to give me support to go anywhere on the base other than secret or top secret. I mean, nobody gets that except if you have clearance. But anything that didn't require secret clearance, I could go anywhere. I could attend all the exercises. I could go into any buildings. And I had a driver, and I had my own helicopter.
Now you're talking. Now, yes. That's another reason to be a photographer,
that's
right? You get your own
bad.
Photographer,
that's
your own
bad.
Helicopter.
My own helicopter. I mean, you know, there isn't anything better than a helicopter doing a side sort of a chandelle and feeling negative G's. And it was wonderful. And I've been to 2 aircraft carriers and 2 amphibious carriers.
Cool.
And I've been tail hooked a number of times and catapulted.
So
it's pretty exciting.
And so now you're going to turn this experience into what?
I've got to do a book. Yeah.
Okay.
I've got to do a book. And I was under contract with Aperture some years ago to do a book on me and my collection. And they sent a writer in to debrief me. And Carol Kismerick, who has since deceased, who was a very, very dear friend. She was one of the, she was really the editor of the Life Photographic Book Series.
Mm-hmm.
And of the entire series, and she was the main editor of a number of the books in that series, and she was a dear friend and a positively brilliant woman, visually brilliant, and as nice as any human being can be. And Carol did not like the text, I didn't like the text, and we killed it, and it never happened again. Somebody at Aperture had said that they had wanted to do an interview similar to what you're doing now of me. This is of recent date, and I wouldn't be surprised if I got a call, because some of these things ought to be memorialized in print, things I haven't written in the book. And I have another number of anecdotal situations, most of them pretty good. I mean, photography has been very, very good to me. It just never brought any grief into me other than the damned computer.
Well, I got one more question for you, which I always ask, and we always try to ask during our Behind the Lens podcast.
Yes.
You've been there and done everything. You spent your life as a photographer. How do you see things different now than when you started out? You know, what's new? How has the photography world changed? And then more specifically, do you have any advice, suggestions, tips for aspiring photojournalists or just photographers in general of what, you know, what words of wisdom that you got maybe from some of these old masters would you like to pass on to our next generation of photographers?
Well, you just have to work at it. And everybody says, you know, develop a style. And before you show work to anybody, get 20 pictures that you're very proud of. You just have to keep shooting. And unfortunately, or fortunately for photographers, everybody now is a photographer because the cameras really think for you. I mm-hmm. mean, that's the good part. The bad part is that everybody now is a photographer and the cameras really think for you. Somebody quoted to me somebody who was earning a living in photography as a commercial advertising, whatever, because that's a very tough field now. And they said it's turned photographers into bums and bums into photographers because everything is so automated.
Right.
You can't miss. You just can't miss. I mean, if you have your control set reasonably right, you're going to get the picture.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a matter of who has the eye and who can really see the frame. And when I was photographing, my book is printed all but three pictures full frame. There's only three pictures that are cropped in my entire book out of 350 pictures. I basically was a color photographer also. I did travel in color. And when I would compose a picture, when you make a Kodachrome, and I used Kodachrome mm-hmm. in the early days, I mean, Kodachrome was just incredible, except what we called the Kodachrome sky, which frequently would fade out. But when the Kodachrome was right, the reds and the greens and mm-hmm. the yellows and the blues, you had pictures. And then Fuji came in, and I did a lot of stuff on Fuji. But my Kodachrome's done when I was 18 years old. That's a long time. Take, you know, 18 away from...
We will let our listeners do the math on that one.
They are as perfect today as they were when they were shot. I mean, it's amazing. It's amazing. That's where we are. So now we're in digital, and I really love seeing the images. And I'm getting some very pretty things out of my digital camera. But I want to see some action. I mean, you know, I still have my press credentials. I'm credentialed still in D.C. you don't want to see a disaster, but you want to be there when something happens. I mean, I still have that photojournalist bug, and you don't. God in heaven, yes. those were good times. And I even illegally, many, many years ago when I was growing, when I was in undergrad school and I went into law school, I had a siren on my car. So hopefully the statute of limitations is long gone. And siren on my car. I had a red light on the, or I should say a spotlight on the side. We had, I had press credentials in those days. I'm not going to tell you how good they were, but those were the days. I was kind of, myself and a fellow named Steve Lasker, who became one of the photographers at the Herald American, the old Herald American, and then went on to be a videographer or video camera person for CBS. Steve and I kind of, we were in high school together, and he went on to work for the papers and really became a photojournalist, and I only became a lawyer.
Well, that is great. Arnold, I can't tell you how happy I am to have a chance to sit down with you and have this interview for the Nikonians community. I want to thank you again for spending some time out of your schedule with me, and thank everyone for listening. And don't forget to keep tuning in frequently to podcasts.nikonians.org for all of our podcast series. We'll see you next time. Thank you.